Right. One thing very quickly, there is information that Mr. Ensign has brought, as well as other information in the back of the room and on your seats, in case you didn't see that. Our next speaker is Christian Parenti. He's the author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis. Right now he is writing a book about the history of surveillance, and he's a teacher at New College at California.
Thank you very much to everybody who organized this. Thanks for the invitation. What I'm going to talk about just briefly, hopefully it'll be brief. I'll try and keep it brief because I know there's a lot of smart people in the audience, and so it'd be good for us to have a discussion. I was asked to talk about the civil liberties aspect of this war, and I'm also going to say something about the role of American empire in the larger problem that we face, which is, you know, terrorism and endless war, it seems. To start with the civil liberties aspect, as you all probably know, there was this series of bills proposed immediately after this happened, right? The administration devised their wish list, basically a fascist fantasy list, and it was proposed as the ATA, the Anti-Terrorism Act, went to the House, became the Patriot Act, which had some absurd acronym about fighting terrorism, and it was watered down there. If you want to be generous, you could say it was watered down by John Conyers. It wasn't really watered down that much. And then it went to the Senate, where it became the USA Act, which is the Uniting and Strengthening America Act. And it passed the Senate on Friday, basically untouched from what the administration has proposed. So, and the argument is that we have to do this. This is a crisis. We've been attacked, and we certainly have been attacked, and this is a tremendous calamity. And it's not all lies when Ashcroft says, you know, there could be more attacks. I mean, of course, he uses that cynically, right? When was that three-day period that the attacks might happen? And I'm sure there were anthrax things that may be connected to Al-Qaeda, but why was he hyping that up? Because that's when this was passing through the Senate. So before we even get into what the USA Act does, we should deal with what powers the U.S. government already had before this to investigate and prosecute crimes. First and foremost, they had lots of money, right? I mean, the FBI is an enormous organization, $3.5 billion budget, close to 12,000 field agents, and that's just, you know, the main federal agency. You got the DEA and all these others. In May, they gave $10 billion to federal agencies to fight terrorism, May of this year. In terms of legal powers, there's pre-existing statutes that give the government tremendous power that were then beefed up in 96. Foremost among these are the right to tap telephones, right? You're all familiar with this. The two ways you do this are, one, Title III of the U.S. Criminal Code, which is the standard way you're supposed to get a wiretap. And what you have to do to use Title III is if you're an investigator, you have to prove that you have exhausted all other methods for getting the information. You have to show probable cause that the target of the tap is really involved in a crime. And then on top of those two things, if those are proven, you then have to show that the tap itself will be useful. So you can't just tap the subject's mother or grandmother's telephone if there's no material connection. So there's another way to get a telephone tap since 1978, and that's through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And in that case, investigators can gather information to use in foreign intelligence operations and therefore not to use in criminal court, where the standards of proof would be higher. And all they have to have there is a reasonable suspicion that there is something going on and that there's a foreign intelligence angle to it. Currently, there are more Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act taps granted every year than there are Title III taps. And these are basically automatic. They are actually automatic. There's no judicial review. A judge has to give federal investigators a FISA tap as soon as they certify a foreign intelligence connection. And thus, they get them all the time. Well, not all the time, actually, because there's one documented case in 20 years of a FISA tap being turned down. So then what they do with FISA, the information there, is then they can build probable cause to get a Title III tap or to search your house or whatever and build a case against you. Another thing they already had before the laws that are now up was the material witness law, which you've all heard about, but probably hasn't been explained that well. The material witness law allows the federal government, in the investigation of a crime, to detain, to arrest people who have nothing to do with the crime necessarily. They're not suspects. They're people who may have important information. That's what a material witness is. And they have over 600 people detained, many of them not even talking to their lawyers, on this material witness desk. Those people are not suspects. They're material witnesses. There's also the grand jury, which is used all the time. When you're called before, they impanel a grand jury. If you're called before a grand jury, you have to answer its questions. If you do not answer the questions, you will go to jail. And then you will pay fines and you will do jail time. And this is the investigation of a crime. This is not the prosecution of a crime. In terms of immigration, they already essentially had unlimited detention. There was actually a lot of case law around that. And then just in the end of the summer, the Supreme Court said you cannot detain an immigrant indefinitely. You have to, within a short period of time, I think it was like a week, charge them with a deportable offense and then try and deport them. But in reality, what would happen is that people would be deemed deportable, and then if their country doesn't want to take them back, they just live in detention forever. And there are thousands of Cubans, for example, who were deemed deportable, and Cubans don't want them back, and other nationals too, Russians and other countries. So there already was essentially indefinite detention. Since the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, another little feature of the immigration law they had was the use of secret evidence. Any immigrant can be detained on secret evidence, which they do not have a right to access. And the interesting thing about that is it doesn't get used that often, and we can talk about that later. Another thing they set up in 96 were secret terrorist courts, which they also don't use, which is interesting to discuss. So anyway, what are they going to get? What are they getting from this? They further merge the FISA and Title III. So they recognize legally the FBI's interpretation of FISA, and they allow the use of FISA more readily in regular investigations. There is legalization of interagency information sharing, which means that the CIA has the right to build dossiers and to investigate Americans here in America, which was, in the beginning of last week, illegal. There is an expansion of pen registration tap and trace laws. Now, this is similar to the FISA warrant. To get a pen registration tap and trace warrant, it's an administrative warrant is really what it is. You don't have to go to a judge if you're an investigator. You just certify that there is a need, and then the judge automatically gives, with no review, the right to log the numbers that a telephone calls. Now, not tap the content, but just to make a chart of what numbers are connecting to what telephone numbers. The FBI have already been using this to track internet use, and there's a big difference, because looking at telephone numbers is very different from looking at websites and email addresses, which have subject headings connected to them. Websites have names and histories. The FBI can then go to that website on its own, right? That's totally free to see what you're looking at. So that will now be legal, and that will be automatic. There'll be no warrant involved in that. They have legalized sneak and peek warrants, secret warrants. Currently, if there's a search of your house, they break in, they search, they have to leave you a copy of the warrant so that you have the right to contest the conditions of that warrant. So if they have the right to search the first floor of your house, there's the case right here in New York, a lot of you are probably familiar with, where the Hells Angels were searched and the cops were videotaping themselves searching. And they searched the, down here on whatever it is, in the Lower East Side. They were searching the first floor, and they say, should we go upstairs? And they say, well, what does the warrant say? And they're like, that doesn't matter, let's go upstairs. And in fact, the warrant said only the first floor, so that case was thrown out. So currently, they're supposed to leave you a copy of the warrant so you can see, well, did they search only what the warrant says? Did they violate their own warrant? And then you can fight it in court. Under the new sneak and peek, they can keep secret for 90 days the fact that they've even broken into your house and rifled through your material. There's a new definition essentially of being a hacker. Anyone who gains unauthorized access to computer systems, which is like not the same as breaking into a computer system. And if there's deemed unauthorized use of computer information or of a computer system rather, federal investigators can automatically, without a judge giving them a warrant, start an investigation of hackers or even people who, you know, are messing around in places they shouldn't be on computer systems. There's roving FISA taps now. So when you get a FISA tap for an individual, you can tap every communication that every communications technology they use. So if you have an activist, you want a FISA tap on them, if you're an agent here, and they use the public library's internet access, they can tap and trace everything happening on the public library's internet system. And all of the person's friends, they can tap not just when the person who is subject to the warrant emails a friend or contacts a friend, but then all of those people who are contacted as well, their communications can be monitored. There's also warrantless access to business records. Certain class of business records have to be turned over. Credit records have to be turned over without a warrant, and education records. Previously, the feds had the right to find out if you were enrolled in a school, your name, your date of birth. That was it. But now they have the right to get access to what classes you take. So you could imagine, right, if one wants to be paranoid, you could imagine how they could start looking for everybody who's studying Introduction to Marxism and build a list that might be useful for something. And most frightening of all is the new definition of a terrorist. A terrorist is anyone, among other things that are obviously terroristic, is anyone who violates a federal or state law in a way that may cause harm to people and they violate the law in the pursuit of making political change. I think it's getting darker and darker in here, or my glaucoma is kicking in or something. So that's clearly about activists, right? You got to keep in mind, right? Who was the FBI thinking about the day before these planes hit the World Trade Center? They were thinking about the anti-globalization movement, right? They were gearing up for a big protest in New York. We have the quotes from May of Louis Free describing terrorists, describing reclaim the streets, describing anarchists in Seattle as people who are, you know, part of a potentially domestic terrorist scene. So anyway, it's a horrible law, right? But lest you get too paranoid, it's important to remember that the law is not simply language designed by politicians or lawyers. The law, the lived life of the law, is determined by the balance of power between the people and the state. Take, for example, the case of secret evidence against immigrants. The fact of the matter is they hardly ever use that. They use it about 10 times a year out of 300 procedures. Why is that? You know, I mean, think about it. There are people in the FBI who would love to go to SEIU and find all the Salvadorian organizers and detain them on secret evidence and get them out of here, right? But they can't do that. And they can't do that because every time they do use secret evidence, they get attacked by the left. And we should take heart in that. And they get attacked by very competent left-wing lawyers who fight them tooth and nail and are actually establishing case law, which is rolling back their right to use secret evidence. More to the point, there isn't the ideological, cultural climate to endorse that kind of action, that kind of behavior by the government. Part of the reason is because the left has worked diligently to create a space to defend civil liberties. And another part of it is that the right wing is having a little bit of blowback domestically of its own. They have, for 30 years, been running against government, right? The function of running against government for the Republicans is to get people to endorse capital gains tax and slashing regulation for big corporations. But that project is dressed up with this idea of individual freedom. And the grassroots right wing believes that part of it. They're not really invested in the capital gains tax. Frequently, they don't even understand that that's the real agenda behind the anti-government thing. And so they think it's actually about the Fourth Amendment, right? Protection against undue search and seizure. And so you have people like Bob Barr in the House. A horrible, horrible right winger coming out and criticizing the bill. And if any of you listen to right-wing talk radio the week that this started coming down, it was full of people just railing against this stuff, doing a much better job than many liberals, it might be said. So they have this horrible laws on the books now, but the fact of the matter is they're not totally free to use it unless there is a profound cultural and ideological change in the country, and that's part of what the whole war hype is about. This being the case, it is imperative for activists and for those of us on the left to be very careful about not trying to curry favor with the state and think that we can advance our cause by throwing bad protesters overboard and creating a space of legitimation for ourselves by sacrificing up some bad, reckless protesters. Because that's precisely the kind of speech and action that will open the way for the government to really use this new law they have. And that brings up another sort of deeper question. The civil libertarians focus on how civil liberties are about protecting the innocent from the excesses of the law. And that's true. But there's another thing that civil liberties do. Civil liberties are about protecting not only the innocent, but about protecting the guilty. Civil liberties are essentially the law's conscience. It's the silent realization within the law that the law itself in the state is fallible and often immoral, and that there is not written in overtly into the law, but subtextually, a right to commit illegalities. And where does that come from? Well, it comes from the fact that all progress in American history involves, to some extent, not necessarily violence, I'm not talking about violence, but illegalities. From the Boston Tea Party to the great upheaval of 1877-78, the sit-down strikes in Flint, Michigan, what were those? Those were massive criminal conspiracies. The civil rights movement, what was that? What was the sit-in movement? Those were massive criminal conspiracies, right? And so defending the right to commit illegalities sounds problematic, and it is. But there is also this very, very important political subtext to that that we need to be aware of, especially if we feel that it's okay to start coming down on bad protesters. So that's all I'd say about civil liberties. Don't panic too much. Exercise your rights, and remember that they'll only use these draconian laws if they're given ideological permission. Or at least that's what I think. So just briefly about the roots of terrorism. Because the other thing is, like, I mean, this is real, right? I mean, like, 7,000 people died. So people have very legitimate questions about, well, wait a minute. This is not some, like, scary story about kids smoking marijuana. This isn't, like, reefer madness justification for a police state. This is a real threat. What's the response? I'm not about to give helpful suggestions to the FBI. But I will say this. The FBI used a lot of the money that it was given to hire translators on hiring agents to get involved in anti-drug task forces. But we have to look at the root causes of the danger if we really want to deal with it. What I mean, one of the root causes is obviously poverty, right? Planet of 6 billion people, 1.5 billion people, according to the UN and World Bank, which the World Bank, of course, likes to put a happy face on things, live in abject poverty. That is, they don't have adequate housing, food, clothing, or access to clean drinking water. That's not poverty. That's abject poverty. So that's the kind of situation that breeds resistance and desperation that we saw on September 11. More specifically, where does this whole constellation of forces come from? Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, the Taliban. It's interesting to excavate the history just briefly, and I would suggest that you all read Ahmed Rashid's book, Taliban. I mean, what happens in a nutshell is King Zahir, who takes power in Afghanistan in a coup in 29, he's then overthrown by his cousin in 73, and there's this beginning of sort of a modernization in Afghanistan. Russian aid is given to this government, even though it's not a socialist government. There is, in 75, an uprising by some Islamist officers, Mossad and Hikmatyar being two of them. They're exiled to Pakistan. Other officers train in the Soviet Union. In 1979, there's a coup against that government. There's a socialist government put in place that institutes many very progressive policies. It has hardly any support in the country, though. There's a left-right split in that government. A sort of a very extreme left-wing faction takes over. The Soviet Union invades, deposes that faction, puts in another faction, and lo and behold, you have the beginning of the war. You have traditional ethnic minorities wanting autonomy pick up arms. You have Islamic groups picking up arms. And you have elements that are really, really radical Islamics picking up arms. But even before that, interestingly, the U.S. government starts funding Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan in 1979. Brzezinski himself has admitted to this in a French newspaper, and you can find it on the Counterpunch site. And the idea was that they could start destabilizing an ally of the Soviet Union and possibly draw the Soviet Union in, and then the Soviet Union would have a Vietnam-type situation. And Brzezinski is very frank about this. He says it was great. It worked perfectly. That's exactly what happened. So So beginning in 79, the U.S. is funding these Islamic fundamentalists. Important to point out is that there are numerous factions on the ground. The CIA, through the ISI, Pakistani Intelligence, and the Saudis, start directing funding, not to all groups, but to the most fundamentalist of these groups. In 86, there's a new escalation in U.S. aid. William Casey, head of the CIA, approves three major changes. He gives 900 Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen. There are now six factions of the Mujahideen, not all of which are getting full funding from the West or the Saudis and the Pakistanis. The CIA and the British intelligence, MI6 and the ISI, approve a plan to send expeditionary Islamic forces into Uzbekistan and Tajikistan to strike into what Brzezinski and the others called the soft Muslim underbelly of the Soviet Union, to bring the war right home to them. And third, there is Western backing for a process that had already begun, which is the recruitment of Islamic fundamentalists throughout the world. And you get eventually 35,000 Islamic fundamentalists from all over the world fighting in Afghanistan, training, having their ideology hardened even more. And Al-Qaeda comes out of this. Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan before 86 and before there was full Western backing for this international brigade, but that really helps create Al-Qaeda indirectly. There was actually, by 88, there was a recruiting booth here in New York where they would send free any Muslim who wanted to go fight in Afghanistan. So eventually there's the knockout blow. The Soviets leave the guy who ran the secret police under the Soviet puppet state is president until 92. He's eventually overrun by the Mujahideen and tortured to death. And then the Mujahideen immediately fall apart. And there's horrible, horrible genocidal war in all the cities from 92 through 96. Starting in 94, and at that point the CIA pulls out, and a lot of forces pull out because they've done their job. The Soviet Union has collapsed, and they're done with these Islamic fundamentalists, many of whom go home to their own countries and start wars there, start jihads there. Out of this chaos and just absolute horrible brutality begins a small law and order movement of Islamic students in the south of Afghanistan called the Taliban. They begin not as a messianic movement to overtake the country and impose Sharia law, but as a group of young, barely literate, generally rural Muslim scholars from the south of the country who are just sick of it. And they start, their first action is to secure, with the backing of a trucking mafia, a highway, to just clean up the fighting on a highway. It works for this mafia, which brings, you know, everything from heroin out to soap in. And they start getting funding, and they begin in 96 this tremendous campaign. Before 96, after this victory and a few others, the ISI realizes, whoa, the Taliban is a force that could bring stability here to Afghanistan, which also becomes important because by then there are real plans to bring natural gas out of the Central Asian republics. And the Central Asian republics have some of the largest natural gas reserves in the world. So there's this idea backed by Unocal and by an Argentinian company called Bridas to secure Afghanistan, create a poor man's Saudi Arabia, and put a pipeline through it. So the ISI backs the Taliban, and the Taliban in 96 sweep the country. They take 21 of 33 provinces, and it's basically stalled there. When the ISI is doing that, the U.S. is supporting indirectly, and then afterwards, the U.S. starts supporting the Taliban directly. The last payment was $43 million to them in May to fight the war on drugs. So if we want to ask, you know, where does this come from? It comes from the practice of empire, in part. Not completely, right? But in part. So, and in, as for the long-term consequences of the war, will it smash Al-Qaeda? Will it kill Osama bin Laden? Maybe. But what it will also do is permanently militarize, well, not militarize, because they already are militarized, but create a permanent U.S. occupation in Central Asia, and that is bound to create more resentment and more problems down the line. Thanks.